Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name's Leon, and I am an alcoholic. And this is a meeting about honesty and recovery. Recovery is very general, but honesty is very precise. So let me start off by saying this is not my real hair. I'm working my way into the honesty part. My recovery date is February 4th, 1990. And thank you. However, we all know it's a one day at a time program. And I have spent the last 25 plus years practicing something that I believe is what I am supposed to do, and that is to get out of the way of myself, work on my character defects, and try to, it's attraction rather than promotion, try to pass on what you guys have so freely given me, a life beyond my wildest dreams. So if you'll indulge me, there's two things I would like to share, and the first one is I would like to pray, because whenever I got into fear, before I got here, I would drink and use drugs to get out of the fear. And what I practice today is using my higher power to get out of the fear. So I would like to start off with the third step prayer, and this is for me. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. Amen. That's the first thing I do when I get in fear. And sometimes the second thing I do is call my sponsor. And I was sitting out front about 20 minutes before the meeting. My wife is up here. She celebrates. She's 35 years sober. And she was speaking over at the GWCC at the 1:30 meeting. And I found myself sitting out here all by myself. And my sponsor, Pat Lydon, he doesn't mind if I use his last name, popped in my head. And, of course, my first thought was, I don't need to call him. He's in Sunset Beach. I don't need to give him a call. And then the process, the internal process of Alcoholics Anonymous said, yeah, maybe I do need to give him a call. Maybe he needs to hear from me rather than me needing to hear from him. And I called him. And he was like, Leon, what are you doing? And my wife and I get around quite a bit. And I said, well, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, sitting here in the Omni, in front of the Omni Grand Ballroom, and I'm getting ready to speak in 20 minutes, and I'm petrified. And I knew what he would say. Does anybody know, anybody have an idea what he might say? Pray about it and tell the truth. That's what he said. Tell the truth. And I know that. I know that. You know, tell the truth. And I'm just going to run real fast forward through my drunkalogue because it's really about recovery. I started drinking when I was 16. I grew up in New York, Long Island. Yeah. All right. I'm still a New Yorker at heart. Even though my office in Arizona, I'm a school superintendent. And my office is all New York Yankees. Go figure. Okay, boo. I got a DUI in 1972. I paid a $50 fine. Didn't think much about it. Got a DUI in 1979. I had a girlfriend. She was pregnant. Went before the judge. The judge said, I'm going to give you two choices, Mr. Butler. I don't think he used Mr. Butler, actually. Let's tell the truth, yeah. He said, you can either go in the military or you can go to jail. And being the self-centered, selfish, egotistical alcoholic that I didn't know I was then, I said, well, this is a no-brainer. I'm going to go in the military. And I decided to go in the military for 6 years because I'd get more money. I went in as the rank of E3, and 6 years later, I came out of the rank of E3. The last 2 years of my six-year hitch, my friends would say, "Leon, do not sew your stripes on. Put them on with Velcro." Because I'd get a stripe, I'd make rank, and then what do you do when you make rank? You go out and party. And I'd get in trouble the very next day, and off it would come. That's kind of funny now. I was married. I did marry that girl, and I had a daughter. And during those 6 years, my wife divorced me, my first wife, and she took my daughter back to New York. And I started something that I learned early on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking and using drugs heavily to get even with her by hurting me. To get even with her by hurting me. And I drank until 1990. This is a progressive disease, I believe, and it is a life and death disease. And this is not a program for sissies. So give yourselves a hand, because we are all here, clean and sober. Woo! My last year of drinking, I had a third DUI in California. I convinced my mother to put me on a plane, and I skipped out of my bail, and I ran to Richmond, Virginia. I was there for almost a year. This is a progressive disease. In the end, I would sleep on my brother's couch. I'd wake up periodically, and the couch would be wet. And I would try to dampen it up and flip it over like nobody knew. And I was there for almost a year, and one night, I was totally unemployable. One night, I was doing what I did every night. I passed out dead drunk, buck naked, and all of a sudden, I was yanked out of bed. And I kind of opened my eyes a little bit, and there were two guys dressed in blue uniforms, and there was a guy all dressed in black. He had a big, huge black hat on, and I looked at him, and I thought, oh, my God. And the Richmond police officer said, "You have 30 seconds to get dressed." And they handcuffed me and shackled me, and the next thing I know, I was in a car with this guy. And Ray brings tears to my eyes because I didn't know it then, but Ray was my angel. The Skip Tracer was my angel. I spent 5 days in the car with Ray, and as I began to come to, I noticed he wasn't 10 feet tall. He was about 5'8 or so. And he looked, when I came to that night, he looked really big and burly, and he was probably about 60, 65 years old. And he had this old scrubby dog in the back that had to be 15. It was amazing. And I spent 5 days in the car with Ray, and he drove me back from Richmond, Virginia, and we got onto the 101 in California in Ventura. It was a Sunday night. This is a long time ago. I remember it was like yesterday. And he said, "Leon," we were on a first-name basis then, he said, "I'm going to stop and make a phone call." And he stopped to make a phone call, and a few minutes later he came back, and he said, "Leon, I am going to take you to your mother's house in Lompoc. I am not taking you to jail. I just spoke to the bail bondsman." And what Ray saw in me, which I didn't know I had at that time, was complete surrender to alcohol and drugs. He saw it. And so that's where my recovery began the next day. I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you guys would have told me, "Leon, get on all fours and crawl across this floor because that's what you need to do to stay sober," I would have done it. And that gift of desperation has become more and more valuable to me as I stick around here. I was about 6 months sober, and I was miserable because I figured the minute I took the alcohol and drugs away, everyone was going to clap. "Hey, Leon, you're a good guy," you know? And the problem was I started to feel everything. I hadn't had an emotion except for pure joy, you know, if I picked up a girl when I was drunk, or pure anger when I was exploding. I didn't know any other emotions. And now I'm sitting in meetings and I'm starting to feel my whole past, those 20-some-odd years of drinking, all the damage I had done. Because you guys said, listen to the similarities, not the differences. And the more similarities I listened to, the more pain I felt. And it got very lonely. So I went, a couple of people, I went to this big speaker meeting in San Luis Obispo. I was about 6 months sober. Big room like this, and I'm sitting in the middle of the room, and I am miserable. Everybody's laughing and joking, and I'm just sitting there, and my insides are turning. And in walks the speaker. Didn't know anything really too much about AA speaker meetings. And behind him, 20 or 30 gentlemen walk in, and he comes up on the stage, and there's 20 or 30 guys line up in the first row, and I'm sitting back there, and I'm going, who's this arrogant son of a gun? Who the hell does he think he is? This was one of my first miracles, another miracle. And he gets up on the podium, and he's a very well-known speaker on the Western Coast. And he's given his pitch, and all of a sudden he pounds on the podium. And it was like he was just speaking to me, and he says, you know that black hole in your gut? You must fill it with God. And at that very moment, it occurred to me, I'm supposed to have that black hole in my gut because I no longer use alcohol and drugs. If you take something away, there has to be a void. And it made perfect sense that I needed to begin filling that void with something. And that's when I began to work the steps in earnest. I would hear things at meetings like, we don't take pencils from work. And I would look at you guys and go, you got to be kidding me. You don't even take a pencil? You know, all of these honesty things. I remember going through, I was in my first year, and I remember I was around Christmas time, and I was going through Mervyn's, and I was buying some Christmas presents, and I had a basket full of stuff. And the gal is ringing it up, and you hear the little bell, ching, 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 ching. And I thought to myself, I don't think something rang up. And it was this brown blazer jacket. And I was faced with that moment of truth for the very first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, faced with that moment of being honest. And I thought to myself, I think I'll check the receipt when I get out to my car. So I got out to my car, and I'm looking at the receipt, and I see, oh, I don't see $49.99. So then my head says, well, let's think it over. Now, I didn't know then that once you take away the alcohol and drugs, my disease rests right between my ears. I didn't know that then. This was a lesson, a very beginning lesson for me, because what happened to me was I was being dishonest, and I knew it. And I couldn't share at meetings. And I couldn't look you in the eye all of a sudden again. And I felt that hole coming back in my gut. And it was like, oh, God, I got to go back and make amends to these people. And this was my first really big amends. And so finally, it took me about 2 weeks. I went back to Mervyn's. I had $50 in my hand. I walked in, and I told the lady, I says, look, about 2 weeks ago, they were ringing me up, and I got this blazer for free. And I just want to pay for it. And she goes, well, I don't know how I can let you pay for it. They had nothing in their computers at that time to do that. So I said, you don't understand. You have to take this money from me. I cannot leave here without you taking my $50. So she sent me up to another department and the courtesy desk, and they figured out that they could take my $50 and they could put it towards some charity they were running. And they did that. And I felt great. I felt wonderful. I physically felt the uplift of telling the truth and doing the right thing. It was amazing to me. And there's been lots of those times. Lots of those times. When I got ready to, when I actively, after I finished my fourth and fifth step, and I did step six and seven, I began earnestly working my ninth step. And one of my biggest amends was to my mother. Because I realized I would do things like when I was living in New York, I'd get in my motorcycle when there's snow and ice on the road, and I'd be laughing, see ya, Mom, never thinking about how I was terrorizing her. Or all the drunken times, phone calls she would get, that I was half dead, Those things were weighing on me. And so my point is, this amends to my mother was just very, very difficult. And I remember she was sick. She was laying in bed. And I knew I needed to do those amends. And so I walked down to her bedroom door, and I couldn't go in. And my sponsor had told me, you pray for the willingness. If you can't do something, you pray for the willingness. And I walked into her den. I got on my knees. I said some prayers, and I just asked God, please, God, help me to walk through my mother's bedroom door. Went back down the hallway, got to that door, went to push on it, and I just couldn't do it. Went back into the den, got on my knees again. Took me 4 times, and I finally walked through the door. My mother was laying in bed. She wasn't feeling good, and I looked at her, and I said, Mom, I am here to make amends. I want you to know I understand all of the problems my alcoholism and drug use has caused you, and I am so deeply sorry. She started crying, and I started crying. And I don't know about anybody else, but it was driven home with me early on. That's not good enough. I needed to say to her, what can I do to make it right? And I asked her that, and I said, Mom, what can I do to make it right? And she looked at me, and all of a sudden, those eyes and those tears, and she looked at me, and she said, Leon, I think I would like you to quit smoking cigarettes.
That's quite the thing to tell someone, you know, who's about a year and a half, 2 years sober.
But what came out of my mouth was something I strive for today. And that was some words of grace, something I knew nothing about. I looked at my mother and I said, Mom, I don't know if I can do that right now, but I'll try. And you know what? 2 years later, I used the 11th step and I quit smoking. And 2 years after that, my mother quit smoking. That was really cool because it really enforced the idea of attraction rather than promotion, not just in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in all areas of my life. So this program has been quite phenomenal. My wife, I'll tell this little story. When I turned a year sober, I had a phone call from this woman. And she used to wear suits to meetings. And I'm a year sober, and she's 10 years sober, and I can't drink, I can't use drugs. And she calls me and says, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee with me? And I'm like, oh, okay. And I will never forget it. It was a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. She wanted to meet. And my parents had given me this old truck. It was a Chevy pickup truck, and it was painted orange. And the orange paint had dripped, so there was no hiding. We used to call it the Regi. And I was sitting in the parking lot waiting for her, scared to death, just like I was before I got up here. And I started praying, please, God, help me to stay in the seat. Help me to stay in the seat. All of a sudden, she showed up. We talked for 5 hours. I told her the truth about all of my life. Thank God I did, because years later, some things came out. But she already knew about it. She told me the truth about all her things. And that was 24 years ago. And we've been married 22 years. That daughter, when I was a couple of years sober, I had lost my daughter. I told you my first wife had taken my daughter. And my daughter was 4 years old at that time. Well, after I met Linda, I had the opportunity to adopt one of her grandchildren. And Marissa was 4 years old. And I started making those miracle connections. There's no coincidences here. God has given me a gift. I lost one daughter, and he's given me another one. And we raised Marissa together. The really cool part about that is my daughter from my first marriage. Of course, I had to make amends. I don't know an alcoholic that comes into AA and doesn't owe the IRS money and probably some back child support. Anyway, I was one of those guys. And I had to start paying, making those amends and paying that back child support. And I didn't see my daughter from my first marriage for 13 years. And I'd go to meetings and go, oh, God, I am so sick of paying this money and getting nothing in return. And you guys would say, just keep coming back, keep paying, keep coming back, keep paying. And the funny thing was about that was God kept providing me just enough money to make those payments every month. And 13 years later, I got to see my daughter. And my daughter now has 5 years in the program. And it was about 2 years ago, she called me up one day crying, and she said, Dad, I can't believe this. Because, see, my first wife still drinks and uses drugs. And so the relationship has totally flip-flopped. It's amazing what this program can do. So I don't know how much time I have left. Probably getting close here. Okay. This is not an ego thing. This is a thing, you know, if you're new, you need examples. You need to know that this program works, and what you put into it is what you'll get out of it. For me, it has always been about fear. I need to overcome fear because I can't drink, I can't use drugs, and so I need to, opposite of fear is faith. And it's about practice, practice, practice. That's what speaking is about right now. For me, practicing to overcome my fear. I am not a glum lot, man. I want to suck everything there is out of life. Everything. My higher power wants that for me. I want to share with you openly what I have found here. And so from a fallen down drunk, peeing on myself 25 years ago, I went back to school. I have a master's degree. I became a school superintendent. I have served in an elective capacity in Santa Barbara County. I was 5 years sober, and I ran for this office. And when I was interviewed by the local newspaper, the first thing I told them was honesty. I said, before we even start this interview, you need to know I am a recovering alcoholic. And the editor and the publisher, they looked at me and said, that seems to be a moot point. You are doing very well. So if you're new, keep coming back. Get honest. Well, the mantra really is trust God. Go to meetings. And clean house. I just went brain dead. And I'm allowed to go brain dead these days. So I just want to thank everyone for being here and allowing me to come up here. And I want to thank my higher power for just a tad of humility. Thank you.
Now we will hear from Joyce Kay from Coral Springs, Florida.
Hi, everybody. I'm Joyce, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Coral Springs group, and I'm here today because I know I'm only one drink away from a drunk. My sobriety date is August 7th, 1977. And this is my 8th International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yay! And isn't it great to be happy, joyous, and free in Atlanta, Georgia, on Independence Day in the United States of America. The topic for today, and I just wanted to tell you this. I was accompanied to this convention by two black belt Al-Anons. And they've been taking care of me all weekend. And I, too, want to acknowledge the Al-Anons that are here today, too, just like they did last night. And the topic is honesty and recovery. And I'll tell you, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't differentiate the true from the false, like it says in the big book. My life was the only normal existence. And it took me a while to get honest because I couldn't face myself. And it was only coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you sharing your experience, strength, and hope that I began to get honest with myself. And I got it in little teaspoons at a time. God revealed to me, you know, shortly one thing right after another. Because I think if I would have gotten honest with everything in the beginning, I might have gone out and gotten drunk. And so, you know, I was told when I came into the program to share my experience, strength, and hope. And that's what I'm going to do today. I was born in a small town in Jeanette, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Pittsburgh. And I always say my hometown because I know after the meeting someone will know where that is and come up and say hello and we can start a conversation and everything like that. I came from a house that there was a lot of drinking in. And I, too, like you, I was filled with fear. I never could expect what was going to happen to me when I walked into the house. I didn't know if it was going to be happy or if it was going to be sad. And I can remember hiding behind the couch when people would come to visit. And although my dad, he belonged, and I don't know if some of you know, he belonged to the Elks, the Moose, the American Legion, the Garibaldi Hall, the Polish Hall. And if he didn't know somebody that belonged to the one of those places, he knew someone that did, you know. So, and they would always go to the bars and stuff like that and take the kids. And I liked all of that, except, you know, my mother and dad would come home and they'd get in a big fight. And I didn't like that part, and I put my head under the covers at night. And, you know, I heard that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that you put your head under the covers, too. And I said to myself, I'm not ever going to drink like that when I grow up. But I went on in my life. I went to parochial school. And living in all this fear, that evil and corroding thread, the fabric of our existence, and it was a fabric of my existence for as long as I can remember. And I would go into church, and I was always looking for something spiritual. I know that that was the hole in my soul, you know, that was there for me. I never fit in. And I would go to church, and I would ask, the statues. I had seen a movie, you know, where there was an apparition, and I said, oh, please come down and talk to me. And they were just like statues, and no one was listening to me. I went on to school, and, you know, we talk about we're insecure and we have low self-esteem. But, you know, like it seemed like everyone in my town was like that, too. You know, we didn't have much. You know, all we did in that area of town was drink beer and go to football games. That was the main activity. I can remember one time, though, when I said I was never going to drink, there were some drinks around the house, and I would take little sips. And one time, someone gave my dad and my mother a bottle of Manischewitz wine. And my mother put it in the cupboard. And I discovered that Manischewitz wine. And I took a little sip of it, and I thought, yeah, that feels good. Took another little sip. And I like to lay on the bed and put my hand on the floor, and the room would go round and round. And, oh, boy, did I like that feeling. And before you know it, I drank that whole bottle of Manischewitz wine. And I was young at the time. And did my dad get it? Because my mother said, you shouldn't have drank that wine. That was for the company. And he says, well, I didn't drink it. But he didn't know whether he did or he didn't. And I wasn't going to say anything. And that was really dishonest, wasn't it? You know? As a result of my fearfulness, my mother sent me to dancing school. We didn't have much money. And I loved dancing, and I became Jeanette's little song and dance darling. And I had that egomaniac with the inferiority complex, and I never knew if my dad was going to show up drunk or sober or whatever. I went on to high school and got in the drama field. And I was a cheerleader, and I had a whole bottle of Coca-Cola filled with whiskey. And I'd be out in the football field drinking that down. That wasn't very honest either. But I could drink the guys under the table. And that, I thought, was my forte in life. And I could get served very early. I like to go into the bar. I'd like to sit down at the bar, light up a cigarette, have a drink, go out and dance, go in the bathroom, throw up, and come back and dance all over again. I was a party girl. I got a scholarship to the Pittsburgh Playhouse School of the Theater, and that's where I met my husband-to-be. And we did some summer stock together, and he was saving $500 in dimes, and he asked me to marry him. And we went on a Greyhound bus, and we went to New York City, and we lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Now, it was right off the Bowery, so I should have had, you know, some inclination. You know what was going on in my life. We had two children. And I was so scared because I can remember him holding me at night. And I'd say, I am so fearful because I didn't know how to take care of kids or anything. But I always say to the women in the program, you did the best that you could, suffering from this disease of alcoholism. As they got older, it was really hard to put out the macaroni and the cheese and the peanut butter sandwiches and all of those things that you had to do. We gave up the theater, and my husband went into computer programming, but in order to make ends meet, and my husband was a drinker. He said he fell into the wrong crowd when he met me. And he got this job at this one hospital, and he called me up, and this is when they had switchboards, so you know I'm really dating myself. He said, I don't know what they're doing here. He says, but they're taking drinks up to the top floor. And it wasn't until he came into the program that we found out that he was working at Charlestown's Hospital, where Bill had had his profound spiritual experience. So the signs were all around us. My alcoholism was progressing. We moved to New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey, and I became a daily drinker and a daily drunk. And he was going into New York working, and I was in Teaneck, and I was the board housewife, and the fights were starting. We had two more children. And one time he called me up and asked me if he could come home. And I says, well, what do you mean, can you come home? I says, where have you been? It seemed like he'd been gone. It seemed like he'd been gone for 3 days, and I didn't even know it. That's how bad it got. So one day I couldn't come downstairs because I was so sick. So I went over to Teaneck Hospital. My oldest daughter took me over there. She was about 17 years of age. And they says, what's the matter? I says, well, I'm so sick. And I really was. I had a hard time coming down the stairs. So he says, well, I'll put you in the hospital. And he said, we'll see if you have an ulcer or anything. I says, maybe I have a gallbladder attack or something. And he put me in a hospital. Now, you know what happens to a person that goes in the hospital for 3 days, doesn't have a drink like I had been drinking? Well, after 3 days, I went into the DTs in Holy Name Hospital. The crucifix came off the wall. The little rats and mice were all underneath the bed. They had to move a heart patient out of the room. And the next day, the doctor said to me, he says, there's nothing wrong with your gallbladder. And this was in 1975. He says, you're nothing but an alcoholic. And, you know, they treated women like that in those days. And I said, the heck I am. I always have these little hallucinations. And I had. And then he says, you need to go to AA. So here I am dishonest again. I says, oh, yeah, I called AA. I'm going to go to a meeting, you know. But I wouldn't tell my name or anything. And I left there, and of course, you know, what happens when you come out of treatment, you come out of a hospital, you come out, if you don't go to AA, you know what's going to happen. Now, my husband was being transferred to Florida, last place I wanted to go to. But we did come down to Florida, and we thought everything was going to be wonderful. You know, he was going to have someone do the yard, and I was going to have a maid, and, you know, the whole business. You know, the grandiosity of the alcoholic. But we brought ourselves with us. And, of course, the kids didn't really want to come to Florida. They left their, you know, friends and everything. But my alcoholism got worse. And one day I said to him, I says, John, I says, you need to call the doctor. I says, because I can't take this anymore. So he got a name of a doctor, a Spanish doctor, from El Salvador, out of the yellow pages of the big book, or of the yellow pages of the book. And that's the doctor that I went to. And I went into the doctor, and the doctor took one look at me. And he says, how much do you drink? And I says, oh, I drink about two beers here and there. And that's why I heard what you said when you went to the doctors, too, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You all drank just two beers, too. So he examined me, and then my husband was sitting in the office, and I walked out of there, and the doctor says to me, he says, you have cirrhosis of the liver. And I was suffering from malnutrition. My stomach was out to here. My eyes were yellow. I was a wreck. And I says, well, am I going to die? He says, you're not going to die. He says, if you stop drinking. And I says, I'm going to die. I can't stop drinking. And then the doctor happened to tell me, and this is my connection with Alcoholics Anonymous. He said that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew that I knew that I knew that there was a power greater than myself in my life. And my daughter was going to celebrate her birthday, and he told me he wanted to put me in the hospital. And he put me in the hospital on August 7th. That was my, I promised her a birthday party. And like I said, we tried to do the best we can with our kids, and we had the birthday party. And that night, I asked God, I says, God, please help me not to pick up a drink. I'm going to try to do better. Because I felt I was so hopeless and so helpless. And my ego was deflated, and God was listening. And he put me in that hospital. I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since that day on August 7th. And it's the grace of God that got me here and the grace of God that keeps me here. And then the doctor said to me, I'm going to put you in the hospital. He put me in the hospital, and sure enough, I had cirrhosis. And two ladies came to the hospital to see me. One was named Mary, and one was named Ruth. And Mary kissed me on the cheek, and Ruth held my hand. They took the time out of their day to come and see this old drunk laying in the hospital there. And those names were symbolic for me. And they asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said I would. And so I got out of the hospital, and my goodness, a whole bunch of women came in a car. They heard I was a rough case, I guess. And they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was my home group. And I've been a member of that group for 37 years and 11 months as well. And I had one guy, I was the only woman in that new woman in that group for a year. And this one guy told me, he says, Joyce, he says, you kept the whole group sober that year because no one wanted to go out and look like you did when you came in.
5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. When I came into the program, I got a sponsor. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is here today, and she gave me a few words of wisdom before I spoke today, and I love her very much. I got a sponsor. I got into the program. But every day for 2 years and 9 months, my husband was drunk. And I was afraid to tell the old-timers, you know, that he was drinking, but I couldn't take his, you know, drinks away from her. But I just went and did, you know, what I had to do. And when I tell you about my first international convention, it was in July of 1980. My husband came in May of 1980, and I went to the convention anyway. I let him home to go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on his own. And we've been married. I didn't know whether I was going to like him or he was going to like me when he came into the program. But we fell in love all over again. And he did pass away 13 years ago. He was in service. He became a delegate of the South Florida area. We were very much involved in service and everything. But, you know, God gives us a strength to do whatever we need to do in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have to drink over anything. And I can tell you that we had the four children. The first daughter married an alcoholic. The second daughter married an alcoholic. They both are very good members of Al-Anon family groups. My third daughter, she became an addict. And my husband and I used to chase her around, you know, to crack houses. And I don't suggest that anybody does that. But she celebrated 29 years in Narcotics Anonymous. And I only have good words for Narcotics Anonymous. It saved my daughter's life. And you know what? We gave the steps and the traditions to Al-Anon and to Narcotics Anonymous. So I owe all that to Alcoholics Anonymous because we gave them to them free of charge. My last son, we call him the bad apple in the family. He hardly drinks or drugs or does anything. But lately, I don't know. He might be a chip off the old block. I can only say that it has been wonderful having this time to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you today. And I told you in the beginning, you know, that I was always looking for a vision. Well, I found a vision. And Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a whole chapter in the big book called A Vision for You. And it says in there, ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man that is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come for you and countless others. That is the great fact for us, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Now we will hear from Dale R. from Plattsdale, New Hampshire.
Good afternoon. I'm Dale. I am an alcoholic. That's just a fact of life for me today, and pretty sure I'm stuck with that stuff. According to you guys, it doesn't go away, so I'll just accept it and move on, right? My sobriety date is January 9th, 1993. Thank you. My home group is the Friday Night Live in Plattsdale, New Hampshire. We have a speaker. And then we take three questions from the floor for people with 12 months of less of sobriety. And they become the topic of discussion for the evening. It works out pretty good. I passed a milestone this year. I've been sober as long as I drank. And I can tell you from my experience, sobriety is much better. Everybody here knows how to drink, so I'll kind of skip most of that stuff. Actually, we're not really good at it, but we know how to do it. If you hear some lines that sound familiar, it's because I listen to a lot of tapes and CDs and a lot of speakers, and they have some wonderful lines, and I love to use them. Wow, what a fine-looking bunch of sick people we got here today. This is awesome. My first experience with alcohol, you know, my parents had four kids, and My dad was a military guy, and he'd go away for months at a time, and he'd come home, and they wanted some alone time. So we'd get a glass of creme de menthe, you know, and we're about this big. And my body remembered that. And when I was 12, one of my buddies said, let's get some hooch, go down the tracks and get drunk. And that was a just a fantastic idea, best thing I'd ever heard in my life. And that was a muscle memory from those early, early days. And so I did what alcoholics do, right? I lied to my folks about where I was going. I stole the booze I was going to drink. I went down to the tracks, and I grayed out, browned out, and passed out. And my buddy dumped me on the back porch, and my father asked me a question. It would take me 22 years to learn the answer to, the right answer. He said, son, what the is wrong with you? And my response was probably along the lines of... But my mind said nothing. I was stronger, faster, funnier, and better looking than I had ever been in my life, and I was never, ever going to stop drinking. And I was 12 years old. Fast forward 22 years. I'm coming out of a weekend-long blackout. I finished up a job on a Friday. We left the area we were working in. My buddy was driving. I slipped into a blackout. I've got a couple of vague memories about the weekend, and I came to on January 9th. It was very dark because it's 6 o'clock. It's dark. It doesn't matter if it's AM or PM. I had one foot on the floor. I was fully clothed, had no idea where I'd been and what I'd been doing, and I just started bawling my eyes out, and I asked God to please make it stop, and I have not had a drink since that moment. God struck me sober. I began to put my life back together, and part of that, I had to go to this to jail for a week, a multi-offender program from the DWEs I'd had, and it's minimum security jail, and they talk about your relationship to alcohol. And when I was in the Navy, I had achieved a rank, and they had sent me through these classes, and I knew the questions to ask and the answers to look for to see if someone, my subordinates had a problem. I'd already lied my way through a couple of these programs because I knew the answers they were looking for, so I made sure I didn't give them that. And on my way up to this particular one, I decided I would be absolutely honest and see what happened. Let the chips fall where they may. And I discovered an awful lot of things while I was up there being honest and giving these people some honest answers. But the most significant thing that happened to me was a guy came in on a commitment. And, I didn't know what it was then. He had a beret on and a couple days' growth on his chin and a wooden leg, and he was looking around the room, and he just picked me out of the crowd, and he looked right me dead in my eye, and he said, son, what got you here? Why are you here? And then he gave me the answer. He said, booze, and don't you forget it. And you know what? He was absolutely right. He shattered that wall of denial I had been living under all those years, right? Denial. D-E-N-I-A-L. Didn't even notice I am lying. You know? And it was a direct line back to every major event in my life. Loss of job, loss of career, the end of my Navy career, all those sweet relationships I'd killed, every one of them. In an instant, I could trace them all back to booze. Every single one, without exception. I got out of there on Labor Day weekend, Friday of Labor Day weekend, and I went to my home group. It was the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting I walked into under my own power. And a guy speaking from the podium he was really a funny bastard, and he was talking about alcohol and problems he had with chocolate cake. And he was wonderful, and we had another guy speak from the floor, and he talked about the ABCs of Alcoholics Anonymous, the ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. You know, if you want what we have, do what we do. Show up early and help set up. You know, stay late, help clean up. Get right in the middle. Because it's like a pie. And if you're in the middle, you got to work your way through all the filling to get to the edge so you can finally fall off. And someone will probably stop you on the way. He said, but if you don't do that, if you just show up at the last second, split right after the Lord's Prayer, no one knows you're there, you're always on the edge. And when you fall, there's no one to stop you. And I found that to be absolutely honest. And another guy spoke from the floor. And what he said was, if I said this. He said, if you say the third step prayer from the big book every day for 30 days, your life will change. I'd just gone through bankruptcy. I spent a week in jail. You know, it's Labor Day weekend. I got nowhere to go and nothing to do. And I had absolutely nothing to lose. So I figured I would try that. I won the big book at the raffle. Go figure, right? I go see the guy after the meeting, and he told me the absolute truth. You know, he took that book in his hands, and you could tell the way he held the book that he absolutely adored that book. And what he told me was that the very first page of that book had everything in it that I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous and staying sober. I found that to be completely true. I'm still mystified by it today. And he told me where to start reading. He told me to start reading immediately behind the table of contents, or I would miss all the information I needed that would probably save my life. And then he showed me where that beautiful prayer is that we said earlier when Leon was speaking on page 63 of the big book. And I went home and, you know, being self-important and all that, and nowhere to go and nothing to do, I read the book cover to cover like it was a novel. And, you know, God graced me with a pretty decent mind. I got good retention and good comprehension. And what I found out was I found out why they wrote the book. I found out who wrote the book and what the purpose of the book was. And most importantly, I found out the answer to that question my father had asked me 22 years before. I was an alcoholic. I had a disease that was physical, mental, and spiritual in nature. I would obsess, I would think of a drink to a point of obsession, and I couldn't think of anything else, and I would finally take a drink. And then I had to continue to drink because the physical compulsion would kick in, and the immediate loss of spiritual values, and I would do anything to keep going. And I found that to be true. And when I look back at my very first drink, I had the loss of spiritual values before I picked up my first drink. It's an incredible thing. So I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous routinely. And, you know, I didn't have a rights to drive. I couldn't drive in two states. And guys were giving me rides. And we had that good meeting before the meeting, then the meeting, and that wonderful meeting on the way home after. And I started talking about asking questions about the steps, you know, being powerless over alcohol, and they explained all that to me. And I asked him about life being unmanageable, and one of the guys laughed at me. He says, you're going where you don't want to go, with people you don't want to be with, spending money you don't have on things you don't need. He says, you don't think that's a little unmanageable. Okay, I could see his point. And then, you know, we talked about the insanity of alcoholism, you know, how that mental obsession would just come in and push everything out, everything. It didn't matter. You know, why would I go to a bar that a week before I had got the shit kicked out of me by somebody I'd never met over some stupid, trivial thing and sit there and drink with the guy? Is that insane? I mean, it seems insane to me. And then the third step, you know, the third step prayer that I was already saying every day, and my life changed. You know, I went on Labor Day weekend, and by my birthday on the 24th, I had my rights to drive reinstated. I had come into some money. And I had a new job. You know, in under 30 days, my life had changed unbelievably so. And I continue to say that prayer every day. I said it this morning when I rolled out of bed. It's the first thing I do unless, you know, nature calls first. But it's the most important thing I do every day is ask God to guide my thoughts and actions throughout the day in all areas of my life, all of them, you know. He took away booze when I asked. I asked him about drugs before that, took that away. I asked him about cigarettes at 2 years of sobriety, and he took that away. You know, God has been just wonderful to me. So I have no problem with that stuff. And we got into talking about the fourth step. You know, I had this urge to write and ask a lot of questions and blah, blah, blah. And I am not a person that will sit at the kitchen table and write. It's just not going to happen. So I got involved in something, and I started moving forward with that. You know, a group of people in an AWOL, and that's what I needed. And I got all that stuff down on paper, and I've done that process many times. And recently I just finished another one with a big book step study type group, which was really a great experience. You want to get that? Could be God. Going through that four-step process, you know, I know what I did. You know, even some of the stuff that was in gray outs has come back. You know, I know what I did. The person I did it with, they know what I did. God knows what I did. And, you know, hopefully the people I did it to aren't that familiar. But, you know, it's just a rehash of the facts. And I put that, you know, I would pray first, and I would put that all on paper and take a long look at it. And a lot of things came out, and I could see some patterns to my life, you know. And then at this point, you know, it's just me. It's just my head. I'm asking questions. I'm not inviting anyone to the party. And then it came time for that fifth step, you know, the one we really dread, where we have to bear our soul to one human being. It says a human being in our big book. It doesn't say 15 different ones. So God had put this guy in front of me, and I went with it. And I read him my fourth step, and we went through this whole process. And it was great. You know, I got immediate relief from the things I had done. You know, I felt better about myself. I could see the patterns of my life. And he pointed out a few more as I was going through it. You know, he would say, go back two or three and read that again and then read this one again. And I could see these patterns emerge and my character defects coming out and the reasons why I made the choices that I made. You know, they all became clear as a direct result of that process. Thank you. So, continuing on, you know, I got that done. And then it says we go and sit quietly for about an hour. And I went and I sat quietly for about 4 minutes. And more was revealed. So I called my sponsor and I said, you know, this came up and that came up. And he said, that's a little too much to do over the phone or right away. He said, write it all down and then we'll get together and we'll go over it again. And I did that, you know, and it took a while for our schedules to sync up. So I got to carry that for a little while. But I finally got that done, you know, And I went home and I sat for an hour and nothing came up. Absolutely nothing. And thank you, God, you know, that part of it was done. And now the work would begin, right? Because I had all these character defects and I could see them clear and I had to ask God to relieve me of those. And the unfortunate part of that is that it's as he sees fit, not as I see fit, you know. And it's those to be helpful to him and my fellows. So some of those character defects, on occasion, I take my will back and they roar. You know, and I can cause an awful lot of chaos without meaning to and bring some harm to others without meaning to. And I'm working on that still. But based on that, you know, that fourth step list I had, we started making a list of people that I needed to make amends to. And there were a few other things that I had to add to that list, and I've gone around. And some people are dead because they drank like I drank. They did the things that I did when I was active, and I wrote them letters. You know, my mother was dead, my brother's dead. Joanne, Bobby, Mike, a lot of people are dead. So I wrote them letters and I left them on their graves, and that's all I could do for them. And I did a lot of stuff, you know, that you wouldn't really want the local police to know about, monetarily speaking. And our big book talks about being of maximum usefulness to God and our fellows. So my amends for them is financial, and I give generously to my church. I give generously to Alcoholics Anonymous. I give to a couple of other charities, but Alcoholics Anonymous is the only one that saved my life, so I give heavily to them. If you guys are giving to another charity very heavily and giving nothing to Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe you should look at that. AA saved my life, and that's all there is to it, hands down. And not only did it save my life, but it gave my wife at the time and my children, a good father, my father a good son, my sister's a good brother, and everybody's got a much better life as a direct result of that. And I'm not a threat to society at large every time I get behind the wheel of a car, although when I get a little late, you know, some habits come up. But I'm not what I used to be, thank you, God. You know, I'm not as good as I will be, thank you, God. You know, there's always more to be done. And today the 10th step has an awful different meaning for me, you know. Continued what all the stuff I did before, you know, all of it. I look at my behavior, my actions throughout the day, right? Quick inventory before bedtime. Where was I selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? Do I owe an amends? Did I bring harm to someone? Is there someone I should call immediately? You know, all those instructions are right in the big book. And I try to do that on a daily basis. My friend says to say nothing today that you need to make an amends for tomorrow. I found that works pretty good, too. And then the 11th step, you know, it talks about prayer and meditation. Prayer is not an issue, you know. I asked God to make it stop 22 years ago, and he did, so that I have no issue at all with God at all. Meditation, a little bit of a different deal. I used to do about 3 minutes, and then things would happen. And I'm up to about 10 minutes before I slip into some kind of a sexual fantasy, but I'm better than I used to be. And of course, the 12th step, having the opportunity. Had a girl. There's some honesty. And then the 12th step, right? Having an opportunity to give someone a chance to get better, to gain some sobriety, to gain some perspective on their life. You know, whether it's making coffee, setting up a chair in the hall, or speaking at a meeting, it doesn't matter. You know, extend your hand to the newcomer and do what you can for them. You know, this is a program of change, right? C-H-A-N-G-E. Choosing honesty allows new growth every day. And God and I love you. Thank you very much.